Session number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, rail 5.
I got out of the truck and I was blocking the road, and this muleteer pulled up sharply with me waving a revolver over my head, and I asked him where the gun team was, and he said totos muerte, all dead. So I had a look at the number on the gun, and it wasn't one of ours, so I had to take his word for it. I did try to persuade him to tag along with me, because we had plenty of ammunition on the gun position and enough men to man the gun. But he wouldn't have it, and shortly afterwards, on a different course nearby, there was another gun being pulled out. And obviously this unit had disintegrated completely, thoroughly demoralized. And I thought, my God, what hope for our chaps. And I continued along now and got off this road and turned left to where I had left guns the previous day. And then I came upon the Dunbar and the others around the two guns. And they didn't know what was going on. And I said, well, now, there is no, so far as I can see, I said, there is no line on our right, because all these men were making their way back towards Madrid. Many had thrown away their rifles and they were panic-stricken. So I said, we'll have to look out. And our cook was there then, the chap Anderson. And he had one eye, this poor chap, and he said, right, I knew you'd come back, Jim. I can go now and collect my kitchen stuff. And off he went. And we never saw him again. Now he probably, the penny was probably on, or had his cookhouse under observation, and they probably opened up and killed him when they saw him going forward. And then we were in a tricky position, and Dunbar obvious decided that we'd have to move and move fast. So we got the guns out and beat a steady withdrawal back then on the right flank of the battalion, the British battalion. And having vehicles, of course, we got there first. And in due course, about 25 men came back in good order, what was left of the battalion. And they sat down under these olive trees, and we had no cookhouse, so we couldn't make any coffee for ourselves or them or any food. And towards sundown, whoever was in command of the battalion at the time said, well, we've got to go back and try to form a line and dig in. And so he said, in view of what's happened, he said, I'm looking for volunteers. It's no good trying to put pressed men of as little training as we'd had into a position like that. And 24 out of these men stood up, and one didn't. He was played out. And before they started to move off, then they had a countermanding order to stay where they were. So we spent the night there. And that was the end of our experience in the Battle of Brunetti, in my experience anyway. And then, of course, Passionaria came to see us and addressed us. Well, it wasn't very effective, because we knew that we had suffered a defeat, and she was speaking in Spanish anyway, which we didn't understand, and the interpreter wasn't very effective, so it was rather a damp squib.
What impression did you get of her as a woman, apart from that?
Oh, very powerful personality.
In what way?
a real firebrand. She had, you know, she was a commanding personality. She did stand out. And I've no doubt that in to someone who understood Spanish, her form of address and so on was very effective. But it was the wrong place for a woman to be, and the wrong place to make speeches, because a hell of a lot of our chaps had been killed and so on. Everybody was exhausted, and they didn't there were a lot of lessons to be learned which weren't learned. It was all politics.
How do you mean?
Well, you see, political indoctrination was more important than military indoctrination. As I said, we had 6 days to become an anti-tank battery. Well, the only place that we became an anti-tank battery was on the battlefield, facing the enemy. But the fact that we had a minimum of gun drill made us a bit less effective than otherwise we would have been. Because the... we all stuck to our guns. We didn't abandon our guns on any occasion, and so that we were artillery men. But with a bit more gun drill, I think we would have been more effective. More if we'd had more of the sort of discipline that you have in the Royal Artillery. And for people who didn't have, we had the background of discipline, of industrial discipline, discipline we'd learned in school, discipline I'd learned, for example, in the St. John's Ambulance Cadets, and the discipline of home, so that really we were already soldiers, in a very real sense, in that we would stand by each other, and... Anyone who was worth his salt would always look to the next man to see if he needed help or if he could be helped.
Can we have a look now at the lessons that you learned from the Battle of Brunete?
Yes, well, on reflection, and possibly I felt it at the time, that we were in the same position as the Commonwealth Army in the Civil War. That there was... There wasn't so much discussion as too much preaching. And the preaching wasn't military, it was political. And I suppose this went for the whole of the Republic, that they didn't have a Cromwell who could say, right, trust in God and keep your powder dry. When those were the two main directives, where all the dreams and whatnot were just will-o'-the-wisps.
But some people said that the political preaching was necessary to give the men the incentive to fight.
Oh, this is a load of rubbish. So there were so many men that I met who were in the working class movement, they didn't need to be instructed. And in any case, we were soldiers of the Republic, and we expected what we would get in Britain in war, that politics were put aside, that the only considerations were military ones. And it was a very ironical, or men, some of my friends out there were very well educated, working class men, but extremely erudite and well educated, self-taught. And then there were men of very limited understanding of history or of politics, but who they had the right line, and they would preach to us about the struggle and what was necessary and why and all the rest of it. And it was more tedious in the extreme. We would have been better off if we'd been accepted, which we would have, the discipline of the British Army, keep our mouths shut and get on with learning to be soldiers.
So do you think it would have been better if there had been no political commissars?
Yes, definitely. Because All they did was eventually to get our backs up. Because they were not, while they might be very good in this country at addressing meetings and all the rest of it, we didn't, it was a sort of, it wasn't a boost to our morale, it was an impediment. Because when I compare and contrast that with my experience in the British Army, in the whole of the Western Desert campaign, up to the fall of Tunis, I met only two men of the cloth. And if we had any church services at all, it would depend on the colonel and how many people were around. But you might have a simple service on the Sunday morning, which would last about a quarter of an hour. And our main concern then would be for those in peril on the sea, the men who were running the Malta convoys with the Navy. Now, we didn't need... I doubt if there was any man in the British Army there so stupid as not to know why we were fighting and what we were fighting against. So that there was a very minimum of preaching. In Spain, on the contrary, there was far too much of it.
How much of a part do you think that the people who'd had already army experience before they went to Spain played?
Vital part. Because I recollect that after we had lost our anti-tank guns, or in my case, handed over the anti-tank gun, I was posted to the infantry and then posted to the machine gun company. And there was a chap there, George Fletcher, who became the battalion commander, who was a soldier to his fingertips. And he had the supreme merit that when cover was blown and the guns were firing, he would come around to see how things were going. And I got promoted to number one on his machine gun because the chap who was already there, his idea of firing a machine gun was simply to shut his eyes and press the trigger. And of course, in a matter of seconds, it was a belt-fed, the Maxim heavy machine gun, belt-fed, and it was impossible for the number two to maintain the right angle between the gun and the belt. So you get a stoppage. And George Fletcher came around and he asked his chap what he was doing and he said, "Come back." And I was the number two, and he said, "Now you go on the gun, let's see how you do it." So I just fired in short bursts. And the man on my right then had the opportunity to maintain the right angle, see. And Fletcher was like that. Then he went off to command the battalion. And the chap who succeeded him had been badly wounded at the Jarama and should have been sent home. But the poor devil was left there to go through it all, and really he didn't have a clue. And if there was any action going on, you wouldn't see him near the guns. But he'd come around when the firing had gone down. And I was there, I think, 6 months there, and I never exchanged a word of conversation with that man. He was just uncommunicative. He didn't know how to get on with people, and his only idea was to slap his revolver and say, "If anybody deserts, I'll be using this." He had no moral authority at all over the machine gun company. And on one afternoon, we had a fierce firefight with the enemy, and which we were prepared for. And the number one went off with a bottle of wine to a comfortable spot and had a siesta and slept through this engagement. I was number three on the gun. I'd been demoted by this particular character. And The number two became number one. I moved up to number two. And the poor devil got a bullet across here, which...
Across his eye.
I think he must have lost his eye. I never saw him again. But the bullets were flying thick and fast. So I just stood up, picked him up, and called the number three over and told him to get him back as quickly as possible to the dressing station. It was not a place to start messing around with a wounded man, and I took over the gun. And when the firing had ceased, up comes the company commander, and he said, "What are you doing there?" "Obvious, isn't it?" I said. "I'm keeping the bloody gun firing." "Well," he said, "where's the number one?" "Well," I said, "he was forewarned, and he went off with a bottle of wine for a siesta, and we haven't seen him since." And he said, "Well, where is he?" "Now," I said, "how can I know? I've been handling this gun. I got the number one out, who was wounded in the eye, and I said, I've been keeping, my eyes have been looking that direction. I had no time to look for anybody else." So he sent his second in command to look for this chap. They brought him, and he said, "Right, I'll have you shot for this." It was the latest of a series of escapades by this particular fellow. And he was duly executed. But...
What other escapades had he been up to?
Oh, God, he always had a bottle of wine. He always wondered where he got it from. And he was always wandering around at night. And he had a brother who was with Duffy's crowd fighting for Franco. And his main idea, he told me in one conversation, was that he hoped he'd meet his brother on the field of battle and wipe him out. So a lot of personal animus there. And altogether... a very mysterious fellow.
Did you see the execution?
Oh no, that was done. Yeah, there was a court martial way back. And anyway, we heard that he had been executed because he had been protected by this Irish company commander for quite a long time. And
Why was that?
Well, because he was an Irishman, and they were very stern with their own fellows, very harsh, the ones who got commanding positions, because they were expected to be the personification of knight errantry, superior to the rest of us, you see. And in all likelihood, the chap, well, he, in the British Army, he would be the first of his offences. He would have been sent to the glasshouse for a term. But he was allowed too much rope and eventually overdid it.
Why had you been put on to number three on the gun?
Well, because I didn't do much talking. But if I disliked a fellow intensely, I made no pretence to be otherwise. And there was just no communication between us. Because this poor fellow, in the opinion of one of the survivors of the machine gun company, he was bloody mad. And that was his opinion of him, because he threatened this chap, Sid Booth from Manchester, he threatened to have him shot. And Booth has got a wonderful turn of wit. And he said, "You do that," he said, "and I'll complain to the battalion commander after he'd been shot."
Why had he threatened him with shooting?
Well, because Bruce was a rugged, straightforward Englishman, and he didn't accept the superiority of the ex-ARA blokes. And he was a very staunch, reliable, trustworthy man, and he wasn't going to have anybody talking down to him.
Did the ex-IRA people form a distinctive group?
Oh, they did, to some extent. But, and there were one or two very good men They're very good commanders. And then there were even better ones who had served in the Irish Army. Paddy O'Day and one or two others who really were soldiers, extremely competent and brave men. But they were a small body. And of course they didn't want to serve with the British or under command of the British. And that's one great service that Bill Painter, the South Wales miners leader, did for us, was to quash any idea that we should be in national groups. Because at the maximum, we were about 149 Welshmen. Well, if we'd been all together, there'd have been very few of us left after an engagement, and that would be that. Now, the Irishmen were the same. Well, they were a smaller group, and it was an utterly ridiculous idea. I mean, we'd fight better as Britons than we would as four distinct nationalities. So he quashed that. He pointed out how ridiculous it was, rightly so, and that stupid idea was squashed.
You talked about desertion. Was there much danger of desertion?
Well, there were a considerable number of people who had volunteered, who thought that having volunteered to go in, they could volunteer to go out. And after their experience in the front line, at the first opportunity, a lot of them just cleared off and made their way home by devious routes. Others momentarily broke and panicked and deserted, but they came back and were better soldiers for the experience. But the one thing we never did was to twit them about it when they came back. We just ignored it and welcomed them and saw to it that they had good companionship. And of course they were very much against all the political razzmatazz that we had to endure, because they thought it was very hollow, because they had come out to serve the Republic. And some of them had come out as communists, and they got very sick of it. But it never occurred to these people that perhaps they were not doing the right thing. That you can have too much attempts at political indoctrination and all the rest of it. And they were a sort of closed circle. They were like the Jesuits going into South America, for example, to convert the heathen.
Can you tell me about the role of Nathan, far as you personally saw it?
Well, Nathan was a superb commander. And excessively brave, and he always had a little swagger cane which he carried around, but he'd never bend to enemy fire, which was very foolish.
He'd never duck?
No. And he had a charmed life, but on this particular morning, I don't know, he must have been filled with premonition or something, because he had a chat with me, and the main thing on his conscience was some of the things that he'd had to do with the Black and Tans in Ireland. And the Irish knew it, but they didn't want to shoot him in the back or anything. And as he told them, well, we've grown up since then, and here we are in the common cause. But he was talking to me about this, and I made a few remarks, and he was a chap that you automatically liked and trusted. And so he said, well, I'd better get on now, and he searched around in his pocket, and he found a Spanish ornamented leather cigar case. And he gave it to me, and he said, well, there's something to remember me by. And he walked along this sunken road, and I am convinced that it was a bombing raid As I say, it was artillery fire, but I'm damn sure it was a squadron of bombers that had come over, and he was walking right into it, where the bombs were dropping. And of course, all he had to do was to throw himself down, and the bombs would have exploded harmlessly around him when he'd have been out of the sort of field of fire. But he didn't, and he got badly wounded. And then he died as a result of his wounds. I don't think he got very far from the front line. And this is what happened to so many of them, see, that they died without need. And I remember the same thing happening with Lord Harding. We were drawn up the 7th Armoured now, like greyhounds in the slips, because we were going to tackle this hill in front of us. I think it was north of Tahuna, and we were going to go for Tripoli, hell for leather. Nothing was going to stand in our way. So General Harding, as he then was, came up to give his commanders now the order to forget about Tripoli, to turn west and make contact with the armour of the Africa Corps, with the rear guards. And there was a hell of a feeling of despondency came down on them, you see. Well, now, there was a very competent German observation officer with a troop of, 105 or 108 millimetre guns. And here was this gathering now of the chief officers of the 7th Armoured, and among them was my battery commander, John Hamilton Bogue. And he was telling me a couple of years ago that we were talking about it. And I said that Field Marshal Lord Harding had the wrong idea about what had happened. He thought that he was up on a tank, and this shell came over and hit him, you see. But it wasn't. They were standing there now, the group of them, with the brigade commanders and the CRA. And this fellow, he just loosed off one round, one salvo from his four guns. And they landed just forward of where this group was. And General Harding was the only one who was wounded badly in the shoulder. And I noticed then there was a drawing together of these officers, and he had told them to gather round and to get him into his car, and off he went for medical attention. And the others now dispersed to their commands, and the division turned left and moved off to the west.